This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, September 5, 2002. I'm Deepa Fernandez. U.S. lawmakers continue to hear alternatives to war on Iraq. An exclusive Free Speech Radio News interview with a Colombian right-wing paramilitary leader. And as memorializing September 11 gets underway across the country, communities of color gather near Ground Zero to have their voices heard. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Representatives of Arab nations issued a statement of solidarity regarding Iraq after a two-day summit of foreign ministers. Paul Shem reports from Cairo.
Arab foreign ministers ended 2 days of talks in Cairo by categorically rejecting any threats of attack against Iraq by the United States. They said such threats are directed against the security of all Arab countries. And a military campaign would, in the words of Arab League Secretary General Amr Moussa, quote, open the gates of hell, end quote. Instead, they called for Iraq to open negotiations with the United Nations over returning inspectors to the country and allay any fears about weapons of mass destruction Iraq may be developing. In contrast to the 1991 Gulf War, Arab states this time are united in their opposition to any new attacks on Iraq. Ministers also urged the implementation of United Nations resolutions applying to Israel. This is Paul Shem in Cairo for Free Speech Radio News.
Elsewhere in the Middle East, the trial of the most senior Palestinian leader to be charged by the Israelis started today, and the Israeli prime minister rejected Europe's proposal for peace in the region. Awad Dadavis has more from Ramallah.
The Israeli public prosecutor announced the charges of killing, incitement to kill, and being a member of an illegal organization against Marwan Barghouti. Barghouti faced the second session of his trial without his attorney since he considered the court illegal. The trial was held under tight security measures in Tel Aviv with the presence of Barghouti's family and parents of Israelis killed in suicide bombings. At the political level, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon refused a European peace plan. Sharon said the same plan includes elections that will lead Yasser Arafat and his Fatah movement once again to the power, which won't bring peace, and that it is unrealistic to talk about a Palestinian state in 3 years' time, according to him. Awad Davis, Free Speech Radio News, Ramallah.
Nigerian legislators have made public 17 allegations against President Obasanjo that will be the basis of impeachment proceedings. Two of those allegations claim the president used the military to kill civilians on behalf of oil drilling multinationals. Sam Olukoya reports from Lagos.
The first instance was in the town of Odi in the Niger Delta region, where troops deployed by the president killed about 1,000 people and destroyed the entire town. The military action, which took place in 1999, was apparently carried out to quell local agitation against the activities of multinational oil companies operating in the area. The legislators say the deployment of the troops to the two towns was illegal because the president did not get authorization from the National Assembly as required by law. The legislators are putting together necessary steps to commence impeachment proceedings against the president. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos, Nigeria.
Boeing announced they won a $460 million Pentagon contract one day before they were to begin negotiations with their machinist union and federal negotiators this week. According to this report by Martha Baskin, some rank-and-file members have little faith in the process now going on in Washington, D.C., at the behest of the Bush administration.
Rank-and-file members had already begun to vote on the contract last week when federal mediators recommended that the two sides continue talking. Less than 5 hours into the voting, the Machinist International president, Tom Bothenberger, sent out a memo saying negotiators for both sides had been ordered, quote, to report to Washington and that voting would discontinue. Ballot boxes were sealed. Federal mediators can only recommend that negotiations continue and do not have the power to stop a strike vote. The disinformation has caused widespread dissension among the rank and file, who feel betrayed not only by Boeing, but by their union. David Clay, a Boeing machinist for 24 years.
You know, that contract is a bad offer, but you know, the union leadership, after all, is supposed to represent us. And when we speak and when we're in the process of making our choice, you know, for our economic livelihood, that's a sacred thing. And that was disrupted. That was removed from our hands.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Martha Baskin in Seattle.
Finally, a U.S. Senate committee has rejected the Bush administration's federal appeals court nomination, Priscilla Owen. Critics of Owen say her rulings demonstrate her personal anti-abortion and pro-business judicial activism. It is the second loss for the administration that's trying to put more conservatives on the bench against a Senate controlled by Democrats with one vote. I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Arab states meeting in Cairo today said they are united against a U.S. war against Iraq. Foreign ministers of the Arab League say attacking Iraq would, quote, open the gates of hell in the Middle East. Back in the U.S., President Bush pressed on, taking his case for war to the American people. Meanwhile, a newly discovered memo from Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld has critics of American foreign policy wondering about the administration's motivation. And some in Congress are wondering aloud if the White House isn't just trying to distract Americans from domestic problems. Joshua Chaffin reports from Washington.
I'm trying to figure out what the criteria is for going into Iraq. Does anyone doubt that we would unite the Arab and Muslim world against us? I mean, would that make us safer?
That prophecy from Illinois Democratic Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky may have already come true. In Cairo today, Arab nations did pledge to stand united against a U.S. attack on Iraq. They're also urging Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein to work with the U.N. and reintroduce weapons inspectors. Iraqi Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz says that if sanctions are lifted, Iraq is ready to cooperate with U.N. inspectors. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld calls the offer, quote, a dance the Iraqis engage in. Secretary Rumsfeld is the subject of a new CBS report. The network says that in the hours after the September 11th attacks, Rumsfeld called for a U.S. strike against Iraq. According to the story, Pentagon notes from that day show Rumsfeld calling for the strike even if there was no evidence linking Iraq to the attacks. The Department of Defense did not return calls to respond to the story. But Rahul Mahajan, author of a book called The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism, says the reports of Rumsfeld's reaction to the attacks don't surprise him.
I've been working on Iraq for close to 5 years now, and my first reaction, one of my first reactions after the towers went down, is that somehow they're going to try to figure out a way to tie this to Iraq and to a war on Iraq. The United States is very much concerned with controlling the politics of the Middle East, because control of the flow of oil is then a very potent source of political power over not just enemies, but allies like the European Union and Japan.
Secretary Rumsfeld and Vice President Cheney took their case for attacking Iraq to members of Congress Wednesday and today. Senators, both Democrat and Republican, said Wednesday they heard nothing new about the threat Iraq might pose to the United States. In the House of Representatives yesterday, Ohio Democratic Congressman Dennis Kucinich said the administration is using the talk of war to distract the American people from other issues, like the economy, corporate scandals, and unemployment.
When people take an oath of office to serve the government and the people of this country, and then there's this huge crisis that they helped to create, and then they tell you there's no solution to this crisis except to bomb, we have to start asking some more questions of people that are saying that.
U.S. defense officials say American and British forces bombed a military facility southwest of Baghdad today in response to an Iraqi attack in Iraqi airspace. According to the Pentagon, it's the 35th such Allied bombing this year. President Bush takes his case for a wider war on Iraq to the United Nations on September 12th. Josh Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
As New York City enters the week of September 11th, we must hear the voices of the tens of thousands who have been silenced, attacked, and continue to have their civil liberties and constitutional rights violated.
As the country begins to memorialize the lives lost on September 11 last year, yesterday in New York City, people from communities of color gathered on the steps of City Hall, kicking off a week of events nationwide to remember all the victims of the attacks almost 1 year ago. Organized by the National Coalition Racial Justice 911 and Third World Within, yesterday's event drew much media as participants from communities gravely affected by September 11 demanded to be heard. Mon Ami Molik is with Desi's Rising Up and Moving.
The war, domestic war on terror and the international war on terror are targeting our communities. And that in the last year, we've seen heightened amounts of racial profiling. We've seen an expansion of incarceration of people of color and of particularly of immigrants. And we've seen at the same time our homes and our countries being bombed and being targeted by U.S. foreign policy.
Highlighting the situation of many immigrants and people of color was Sultan Salim, who used to work at the Windows on the World restaurant on top of the World Trade Center. While he was not killed that day, he has not found work since, a situation that is very common among his colleagues. And he says the government has not helped much.
I am from Bangladesh. September 11th, I lost my job at the Windows. We have lost everything. I have lost 73 of my co-workers. Since then, we have not found any job, and it is very hard to find a job there. The government, even they don't care about us, that didn't extend our benefit. If you have a war, you are spending lots of money on war, and the economy of this country is suffering. If they spend more money at home than on the war, that will produce more good jobs for us, and that what we need. We need job, not war. We need security, not war.
Similarly, domestic workers in New York City, who already earned less than a living wage, and overwhelmingly women of color, have been economically devastated by job loss post-September 11. Jennifer Macias, a full-time nanny and member of the Women's Worker Project of CAV, says for undocumented domestic workers, it's been impossible since September 11.
Many nannies and housekeepers lost their jobs when their employers lost theirs, or when our employers move away from New York City. After working 70 to 80 hours a week at sub-minimum wages for years, we wondered how can we support our families, our children. We were afraid of the INS, so we couldn't get relief. For those of us who still had our jobs, our work got harder because employers knew how hard it was to get a job after September 11, and some took advantage of that. They cut our pay, they cut our hours, and they made our jobs harder. We were so afraid of losing our jobs that we took the abuse and suffered in silence.
So as the media have begun memorializing 911, now less than a week off, with many specials based around the victims who lost family members that day, elected officials are chiming in with vows of no more 911s, as they speak proudly of their efforts over the past year to keep the nation safe. One New York City Councilman Representative John Liu of Queens had a different message.
The Attorney General and the Bush administration and their practices of what I consider the most blatant types of profiling on people's skin color, on the religions they practice, on the countries that they come from. And I just want to take this opportunity to quickly remind Attorney General Ashcroft that that kind of profiling is not what this country is all about. It just ain't American.
Activities in the week-long racial justice memorials will take place in Atlanta, Durham, North Carolina, Chicago, L.A., Miami, Tennessee, Providence, San Francisco, and Seattle. As of this morning, the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta and Georgia have confirmed 737 human cases of West Nile virus nationwide. The death toll stands at 40. The CDC has sent field teams to Louisiana and Mississippi, which combined account for 11 deaths and 296 total cases. Louisiana's U.S. senators have called on the Air Force to conduct aerial spraying against the mosquitoes that transmit the virus to humans. KPFA's Kelia Ramirez takes a look at the role the military plays in pest control.
The 910th Airlift Wing of the U.S. Air Force Reserve maintains aerial spray capability, providing pest control primarily for military bases. The 757th Airlift Squadron, based at Youngstown Air Reserve Station in Ohio, conducts the actual spray missions using C-130H Hercules aircraft, the cargo workhorses of the American military. The Pentagon has maintained an aerial spray capability going back to World War II. Lieutenant Brent Davis, a public affairs officer with the 910th Airlift Wing, explained the mission.
The original purpose for our aerial spray mission is for wartime. If we had to go into an area that was full of disease-carrying insects and our troops are there, we could actually spray and knock down a lot of those insects that would cause harm to our people. From a peacetime aspect, whenever there's insects that are getting out of control, the requester can go through certain channels and see if we can spray.
Before spraying in Louisiana could start, the 910th would have to be formally tasked with the mission. The Air Force would supply pilots, navigators, and two C-130Hs, each equipped with a 500-gallon tank. It would be Louisiana's responsibility to provide the pesticides. Mary Lee Orr, executive director of LEAN, the Louisiana Environmental Action Network, said that the state has not yet held discussions on what they will spray.
We have actually called the Department of Health and Hospitals and asked them about the C-130s being brought over here. They themselves did not know what chemical would be put in there. We're talking an enormous concentration of chemicals. Some folks feel that it's just too much, a little overkill here on the West Nile virus. We need to take reasonable precautions and not call in the Air Force.
Spraying would be done from altitudes as low as 100 to 150 feet. According to Lieutenant Davis, whatever chemical is sprayed would be applied as an ultra-low-volume mist. Half an ounce can cover an acre. Davis said there are several products available, none of which he named, that are safe for humans. But he acknowledged that there are risks to other species.
Whenever we do a spray mission, there has to be word out to the beekeepers because it would be very harmful to honeybees and the like. As far as fish, we would have to avoid any areas where there's fish eggs and those kind of things.
Although the number of cases and deaths in Louisiana has been stable for about a week, the Pelican State still leads the nation with 205 total cases, and its 8 deaths are the nation's second highest total. So speaking out against a possible Air Force spray mission is politically unpopular. Again, Mary Lee Orr.
Politically, it's very difficult. Not very many people want to come forward. And we're not saying we don't want to be protected. We just want to say that we know in the past we sprayed DDT. We've done some things to the environment that have been harmful to the health of people and not necessarily the most effective means with what's happening. So we're just saying let's use caution. Let know everything that there is to know about it and not bring in the Air Force and bombard the people of Louisiana who already have other issues. And do you know that actually when I did the only press I've done on it, because people are really afraid of this subject, so I appreciate you talking about it, one woman saw me saying pretty much what I'm saying now, and she's like, that woman wants to kill people. Isn't that disturbing?
Mississippi has also seen its case and death rate stabilize, but Orr said that in recent days that state has also started looking into bringing the Air Force in to combat West Nile virus. And the Air Force may become an option more states consider as the virus, which arrived in New York City 3 years ago, spreads across the nation. Illinois has overtaken Louisiana as the state with the largest number of CDC-confirmed West Nile deaths, 9. And Illinois has surpassed Mississippi for second place on the list of total cases with 165 to Mississippi's 104. Human cases have been confirmed as far west as Texas and North Dakota, animal cases as far west as Montana. Captain Mark Breidenbaugh, an entomologist with the 757th Airlift Squadron, says the states west of the Rockies won't be spared.
The mosquito isn't the one transferring the disease. The West Nile virus is pretty much accepted that it's moved around by birds. The mosquitoes that can transfer the virus to humans are already in place, so it's just a matter of birds arriving with the virus in their blood and then the mosquitoes feeding on them. There's very few people who don't see it making it to the West Coast.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Kelia Ramirez.
The future of the U.S. coca spraying regime in Colombia is in question as the State Department now has to get congressional okay to buy more chemicals, as right now they're out. A new federal law mandates the State Department to prove to Congress that the program is legal by U.S. health and safety standards. The State Department sent EPA investigators to Colombia, and with the report of their findings due soon, some EPA sources say they were pressured to present data sympathetic to the coca spraying program. Human rights groups are worried this report is a sham. Meanwhile, in Colombia, the United Self-Defense Forces of Colombia, or the AUC, is responsible for approximately 73% of the country's violence and was the fastest-growing irregular army with an estimated 10,000 combatants. Back in July, the AUC disbanded, leaving paramilitary factions in its wake. But the breakup is not likely to change the well-documented collaboration between the AUC and the Colombian Army, which fuels fiery criticism from human rights advocates of U.S. military aid to Colombia. One AUC commander from the Magdalena Medio Front explains his relationship with the Army and his past training at the School of the Americas. Nicole Carson has this exclusive report.
In the jungle of the Magdalena Medio region, Comandante Cero has set up his troops at an abandoned house protected by a paramilitary checkpoint a couple hundred meters from the entrance. The 31-year-old AUC commander is a small but sturdily built, barefoot man wearing rolled-up camouflage pants and eating an ice cream cone. About 17 armed men in fatigues shuffle around and eat ice cream cones too. Their enemies, the guerrilla in the region, are the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, the FARC, and the National Liberation Army, the ELN. He says his troops will be in the zone until the guerrilla leaves, dies, or loses the war.
Then we move to another area and start over again. Fight the guerrilla. No, we don't kill the civilians. That's a wrong idea that people have the self-defense group come and kill the civilians because they want to kill and they cut the head off. That's a lie. We kill just the guerrilla.
The former United Self-Defense Forces of Colombia, the AUC, are more commonly known as the paramilitaries, or the Baracos. Their constant coordination with the Colombian military ignites strong criticism and debate in Congress each year when it comes time to grant hundreds of millions of dollars in foreign military aid to Colombia. The recent rupture occurred after the AUC was found publicly responsible for the 2-year kidnapping of a Venezuelan businessman. Despite that, it is widely believed that the AUC rupture will not diminish their collaboration with the Colombian Army, which are connections orchestrated on regional levels.
I trained AUC when I was in Iraq all the time. If the guerrilla is too much, we coordinate with them. We call the lieutenant. I have a lot of friends in the Army. First we send a guy who talked to them. Hey, look, the situation in this area is very serious. You are in danger of the guerrilla came over here and killed you. And that happened.
Before becoming an AUC commander, Comandante Cero says he spent 10 years in the Colombian Army and reached the rank of second lieutenant. During that time, Cero says he trained paramilitary forces and also attended combat courses at the School of the Americas.
I have 18 combat courses, and that 8 are from the States, and for Benin, Georgia, 93 and 95 and 97 too.
Comandante Cero has much in common with his former boss, Carlos Castaño, the press-savvy AUC leader who recently disclosed his exploits, murders, and personal story in the bestseller My Confessions. Both claim that their fathers, in unrelated cases, were kidnapped by the FARC. After extorting obscene amounts of money from their families and promising to return the fathers, the FARC killed them.
Because I loved the war from a long time. Because I have a lot of hate for the guerrillas. A lot of hate. They killed my father, so what can I do?
In the Magdalena Medio region, the AUC are known for their checkpoints where they tax civilians 5% of all the merchandise they allow through. Civilians say the AUC cuts telephone lines, demolishes clinics, kills people, and conducts mixed incursions into villages with the army. The Colombian Armed Forces cannot receive aid from the United States until the State Department certifies that the Colombian government has complied with 3 human rights conditions. This year, Human Rights Watch, the Washington Office on Latin America, and Amnesty International all declare that Colombia had failed to meet certification conditions in a detailed report. Despite the evidence of Colombia's noncompliance, on May 1st, the State Department certified Colombia and dispersed $104 million, the first portion of this year's aid. Nicole Carson for Free Speech Radio News.
The first of Australia's controversial temporary protection visas granted to refugees by the infamously anti-refugee Howard government will soon expire. For many of the Afghans who fled persecution, this may mean returning to their homeland. Holders of temporary protection visas are required to re-prove their refugee status as the visa expires after 3 years, and for some this day is now looming. However, both the interim Afghan government and the United Nations High Commission on Refugees say Afghanistan is not safe yet, and it may be some time before it is. The Refugee Council of Australia and members of Hazara ethnic minority now living in Australia under the temporary visas spoke at a forum in Sydney recently. Michael Bushell has this report.
Cathy Preston-Thomas, Settlement Policy Officer with the Refugee Council of Australia, spoke out on the Howard government's planned repatriation of Afghan refugees. It's estimated that 95% of the Afghan refugees holding temporary protection visas are part of the Hazara ethnic group who face ongoing persecution in Afghanistan. The establishment of the interim government, led by Hamid Karzai, has not improved the situation for the Hazaras. Cathy Preston-Thomas says if the government plans to coerce Hazaras to return, it may be contrary to international law and would only add to the large numbers of refugees in camps in neighbouring Iran.
There is still factional fighting. Ethnic minorities are still being targeted and police Amnesty International reports on for evidence. And they've been also flooded by returns, by people returning. But while Western countries have promised a lot of aid, they've been very slow in delivering. Australia doesn't need to add to this problem. The situation in Afghanistan is simply too soon to send people back. Australia can't risk putting people's lives at risk, not people who have already proven to have a well-founded fear of persecution.
Also speaking at the forum were three men from the Hazaristan Welfare and Cultural Association. They say their people have been targeted by the Taliban and other groups for more than 200 years, as they are the only ethnic minority who practice Shia Islam, rather than the dominant Sunni, which most Taliban follow. One of the Hazaras, Kadim Fayez, spoke on behalf of his people, saying many members of the Afghan government are Taliban members, and apart from Kabul, Afghanistan remains just as dangerous as ever. One former Taliban spokesman, Abdul Manen Niazi, issued this grim warning to the Hazaras.
He announced in 1998 that there are three options for Hazara ethnic in Afghanistan. They have to be killed, or they have to be Muslim, or they leave the country. We have these three options there, and we have to accept one. There's no changes at all. Those people who are before Taliban just shave the beard and change their clothes, the white clothes to the normal clothes, but they're still there. They are in power.
Kadim Fayez translated the story of how another Hazara at the forum, Ali Amin Amini, had escaped persecution to come to Australia.
I was living in north part of Afghanistan, Mazar-e-Sharif. I observed the massacre and killing of 10,000 people while I was escaping away. And I was in a prison for 8 months. All the prisoners from Hazara ethnic that held by Taliban in Mazar-e-Sharif was 5,000. 3,000 of 500 killed during the treatment that they had with them, torturing with their power, electricity, and did not giving water or food.
Cathy Preston-Thomas urged the government to consider extending the duration of temporary protection visas until the situation in Afghanistan improves, saying international aid is needed to speed up the process.
There's got to be a process where people's human rights are guaranteed in Afghanistan, and you can't have that until you've got an infrastructure. And I guess it's important to think that sending back Hazaras to Afghanistan now would be like sending back the Jews just to Germany just after the Second World War, after the Nazis.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Michael Bushell in Sydney.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.